Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Game one of Cleveland-Toronto. Let me start right there. Game one was really painful for the Raptors. We know this. I mean, truthfully, honestly, it was pretty horrific. To come that close to finally beating the Cavs, only to have it ripped away at the end of the game, was gutting. And Raptor fans, you know, I wish I could tell you that game two was better, but you know it wasn't. Instead, in the span of 48 hours, you had the chance to answer the ultimate question. Ultimate question being, what's worse? A, losing by one in overtime, or B, losing 128-110 in regulation? And the answer is C, they both suck. Saying something sucks is not a take. It's a rule of this program. But things really suck right now for the Raptor fans. They had a great regular season. They've got a pair of all-stars. They've got a Coach of the Year candidate in Dwayne Casey. And still, they had no chance, no shot last night. And no disrespect to the Raptors. I mean, the lazy, convenient thing would be to roll in here and say, last night was the same old Raptors. Or Raptors gonna Raptor. But that's not what happened. Last night was about the same old LeBron. And LeBron's gonna LeBron. Now, what's that mean? That means when LeBron shows up the way he did last night, this guy's unstoppable. He is unguardable. He's unfair. When he's playing the way he did last night, it doesn't matter who else is out there with him or against him. And the worst part for Toronto was the guys who were with him were rolling. They haven't been, not until now, but they are right now. Kevin Love, 31-11. J.R. Swish, 15. Swish is so right. J.R. Swish, 15. Jeff Green, 14. George Hill, 13. But again, this was not about them. This was all about LeBron. This wasn't even about LeBron owning Toronto mentally. And not just Toronto the team, Toronto the city, which he does. But last night was not about that, because he would have owned just about anybody else last night. Here are your facts. 19 of 28 from the field. 67.9% shooting. 43 points. You double the guy, you force the ball out of his hands. Yeah, well, he has 14 assists. The first player in NBA history to have 40 points and 14 assists in an NBA playoff game, and the guy did it with only one turnover. Those are the numbers. This is what the numbers sounded and looked like in action.
Like I told you, I took him two shots to make the shot from the tunnel.
Oh, LeBron!
Oh, boy.
That thing was in the air so long, it should have had a movie on it.
Oh, boy. And then this.
Four on the shot clock for LeBron James.
Hold on.
We're speechless, Hubie Brown.
No.
Oh, my. Man, I still love Hubie Brown. One of my all-time favorites. Oh, my. Oh my, he hit 7 fadeaways in the second half alone, and the shots were comical. I mean, the shots were just stupid. They were the ones that Toronto wanted him to take. If you had told Dwayne Casey before that game that LeBron was going to take 7 fadeaways in the second half, Case would have been cartwheeling all around the room, because normal people do not hit those shots. But LeBron did, and he knew he would. As Kevin Love said, LeBron was telling him the morning before the game that he was going to go out and do just that.
When he went over his right shoulder and then went over his left shoulder, he said when he got the mismatch that he was going to do that. So he actually called his shots this morning. So that's just one of the, I guess, examples that I could use, but just how locked in he was as well.
And when those turnaround fadeaways are deep, that deep, and they're dropping, you can go ahead and cancel Christmas. And pretty much cancel the rest of this series. Kyle Korver, one of the best to ever shoot it, was pretty much speechless after seeing it himself.
When they're game planning, those are the shots they want him to take and want us to have to take as a team. I mean, that's why he's the best. What do you say? You know, amazing shots and amazing game.
And this guy's leaving fellow NBAers and teammates speechless. And Korver was completely right. He practically said what Dwayne Casey said.
At this point, that drains you mentally and physically. Because I really thought OG was playing as tough as you possibly could.
You know, and the couple of times we did double team him, he's such a great passer that you're going to give up a three versus a, he had, I think, 19 non-paint twos or 13 non-paint twos. I don't remember the exact number. But he was making them. And, you know, so you got to decide at that time what you're going to live with. And hats off to him.
What can you do? The guy always makes the right basketball play. I mean, when he's making shots like that, forget it. You double him, he's going to find the open man. The guy will always make the right basketball play. He never not makes the right basketball play. So when he's doing that, he's not just beating you on the scoreboard. He's beating you mentally and physically. He's draining your will to live. He's snatching your soul. When he's doing that, it's not about the Raptors choking. It's much, much simpler than all that. It's that Cleveland has LeBron and Toronto doesn't. Toronto is a good team. Toronto's a good team that's had the horrible timing of being around when LeBron was around. That's the biggest reason they've lost 8 straight playoff games to Cleveland. Not that they're chokers, but they were the wrong team at the wrong time in the wrong place on the same floor with LeBron. You lose 8 straight playoff games to a team, and the question comes up, does LeBron have a mental edge over the Raptors?
I mean, you guys can have that narrative on, you know, how you guys feel about that, a mental edge or whatever the case may be. But for me personally, my mental edge is how I prepare myself every night, how I go about the game plan, you know, trying to not make mistakes. And if I do make mistakes, making sure I don't do it again to compound that mistake. So,
listen, LeBron, since you won't answer the question, I will for you. Yes. Yes, you do. Yes, you have a mental edge over the Raptors. Pretty much you have a mental edge over any team, not named the Warriors. But he is too smart to say that. He's not going to say he's got a mental edge over Toronto and not give them any kind of mental edge back, not give them any kind of bulletin board material, but he is in their heads. How could he not be in their heads? He's leasing with an option to buy in their domes. He knows he's got something for them, and even worse, they know he's got something for them, and that's a bad spot to be in. The only thing worse than being down 0-2 is being down 0-2 to a guy who's got your soul in a jar on his desk. That's me giving myself a Friday tongue. Brian Scalabrine joins me. Brian, good to have you on. How are you?
Jim, how you been, man? I always look forward to these calls in the playoffs with you.
My man, I love it. I'm great, Brian. How about you? How are things?
Good. Good.
All right, let me start you off with your Celtics. They fall behind by 22. They come all the way back to win game two, thanks in large part to a 50-20 run. You've had a few hours to think about this game, so what stood out to you the most about last night's performance?
Well, this is something that the team has done all year long. They come back from double-digit deficits, and it's not that big of a deal, especially in their building. You know, they pick up their defensive intensity, guys like Marcus Smart, Al Horford. They do match up well with the Sixers, and the Sixers came out at a breakneck pace to start that game. You see J.J. Redick flying around. He really does make a lot of things happen. But at the end of the day, you can point the finger at a million different directions, and we tout Ben Simmons for being an unbelievable rookie, and he has been. But he's got to play better if the Sixers are going to have any chance in advancing in this series, because the Celtics are basically saying, we'll play you one-on-one from the top of the key, and if you can drive and if you can finish at the rim, then we will tip our hat to you. But at this point, Ben Simmons is still looking to pass the ball out, and that's not going to get it done against the way the Celtics are guarding him.
Hey, Brian, the way that you raised him last night was something amazing to see. Let me ask you about Terry Rozier. If you go back 2 years, this guy was averaging 8 minutes per game. He played just 39 games. Now he's averaging nearly 20 points per night. This guy's an absolute force on the court. He's a stud. How do you explain how far he's come and how quickly he's done it?
Well, I mean, growth is not always linear. And a lot of times it's, you know, opportunity. Isaiah Thomas was ahead of him, and deservingly so. He was getting it done. But Terry Rozier was putting in the work. And there's a pattern here with the Celtics and these young guys. What's happening is, They're all working with their coaching staff. Brad Stevens puts them in a good position. Danny Ainge knows how to go after the right guys. You know, guys who are sort of like freakishly athletic. Maybe they're undersized in one area, but highly competitive, love to play, and love to work. And that's sort of when you have that formula and you have a coach that does what Brad does, you're going to get guys to perform at a better level than what people think. Now, I could never have predicted his shot to be this good this fast, but I would say the same thing about Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. So whatever the assistant coaches are doing, the head coach is doing, they figured out how to take guys who are supremely athletic long and make them into better shooters than what we are seeing in college. So credit to everybody. It doesn't just fall on one guy. I think you have to look top to bottom throughout the organization.
As two of my favorite people ever famously said, I'm talking about Becky Black and the Hood. It's Friday, and the Friday edition of the Daily Jungle is brought to you by Fan Exchange. There is no better way to spend part of the weekend than at a game or a concert or a show. And I'm not just saying that. I mean that. Take the fam to a game or a show. It is awesome. Head on over to fanexchange.com for a safe, easy, and reliable experience. Tickets purchased on Fan Exchange are always guaranteed, so there's no getting to the gate and having to worry about how you're going to get in. Fan Exchange will get you right there close to the action. Find the very best seats at the best prices at fanexchange.com. You want to use the promo code ROME. The promo code ROME will get you 50% off the service fees on your next purchase. Fan Exchange. They have tickets. And you have yourself an awesome weekend with those Ducats. Brian Scalabrine, my guest. And then you have another guy, Brian, who brings something totally different to it in Marcus Smart. He had 19 last night, but it seems like he always has an impact that goes way beyond the box score. What does this guy mean to this team on both ends of the floor?
Yeah, so I think if the Celtics have aspirations to win a championship next season, and I would never tell any of them to their face that I don't think they're talented enough to win it all this year, because they would look at me like I'm crazy, which is the reason why a lot of these guys are really good. They believe that they are elite players in this league. But for them to win a championship next year, I think Marcus Smart has to be a part of it. Same with Terry Rozier. You got to have bodies to throw at the Warriors and who the Cavs or Philly or Milwaukee or whoever LeBron ends up in the offseason. And so that those intangibles, he provides something that other guys can't do. I mean, you can take a kid at the age of 10 and try to teach him everything that Marcus Smart can do, and he won't be able to figure that stuff out. It's just something, it's innate in his ability. Just watch him. It's like, to me, I like offense just like everybody else, but I equally get excited for defensive plays as well, because I think it matters on both ends of the floor. Watch Marcus Smart guard J.J. Redick and see how close he is at staying attached to him, or watch how he manipulates the screen, whether he's locking and trailing or going behind, or he shoots the gap and gets right back to the body. It is a joy to watch, and I think he is elite and special when you talk about those intangibles, especially on the defensive end.
See, that's what I'm getting at, Brian. I love the guy. I love the guy because he's relentless. I mean, he just keeps coming. He keeps coming. The guy never stops. Now, you mentioned the coaching staff. You've been around some truly great coaches in your basketball career. So what do you think when you watch Brad Stevens do what he's doing right now, and especially after losing the likes of Gordon Hayward and Kyrie Irving?
Yeah, so here's the deal. Everybody in the NBA, and like the elite players are good at multiple things, like name a weakness of LeBron. It's like really hard to get that. But even players that you don't really know of, they have strengths. And that's the reason why they're in the NBA. They had strengths to get them to college. They had strengths to get them to the league. And what Brad does is try to maximize that. He tries to put a guy in a position where, let's just use like a Shane Larkin, for example. Shane Larkin is really good at getting downhill to his right hand. So Brad will run plays for Shane Larkin initiating the play where he can get to his right hand, get downhill, and then play from there. Like, everybody has something that they can bring. And I think of all my coaches, and I have some good ones, you're right, Thibodeau, Doc Rivers, you know, Byron Scott, Lawrence Frank. I mean, I've played for a lot of good guys, good coaches. But none of those guys I've seen make more with less, like get more out of the 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th man than a guy like Brad Stevens. When we sat down at the beginning of the year, I interviewed Shane Larkin and Daniel Tice. I had no idea if those guys were even going to play a minute this year. And both those guys have had an impact. I think that Brad understands what their strengths are and hides their weaknesses.
Brian Scalabrine breaking it all down for us. All right, Brian, so where does that leave Philadelphia? How do you think Philadelphia shows up in Game 3?
I think they'll be energetic by the crowd. They're like Philly crowd right now, they think like the sports center or the sports capital of the world, and everything revolves around them. So I expect the crowd to be just absolutely insane. I do see the Celtics kind of dropping off a little bit. Like, first game they made 17 threes. Next game they make 15 threes. If somehow, some way they do that again on the road, then they're gonna get a win. But I think they'll play better. And I think Ben Simmons is gonna go back and watch the film and realize that he's gonna have one-on-one opportunities at the rim, and it's up to him to get there and finish. So Philly, I don't think that this series is over like I think the Toronto and Cleveland series is over. I think that this series is going to end up being a dogfight. Could be a game 7 in Boston, which is really, really hard to come in and win. But these next two games for Philly at home is going to show us what they're made of.
Right, so before I let you go, you mentioned the Cavaliers and Raptors, and I can't disagree with you. When you look at what Cleveland's done, you know, when you look at what LeBron is doing in this postseason, and when you look at what he's doing to the Raptors, when you look at the guy generally, Brian, at this point, what do you think?
I think the question, Jim, because we always want to make snap judgments, especially in our business, right? Like, we got to, like, go on air, and we got to have an opinion the next day. But we got it's really hard with this Cavs team, and it's really hard with LeBron. Sometimes we watch him play throughout the regular season, and he gives, like, the worst effort on the defensive end you can ever imagine. And then he sort of flips the switch, and you see him for 5 minutes, and you understand the dominance. And you wonder, like, why is he playing 82 this year? Does he feel like this is a way for him to win an MVP? Is he not thinking about the NBA playoffs, the finals? And when you see guys like Bogdanovich play him tough in the first round, like, LeBron lost his luster where people are not afraid of him anymore. But then he goes against in game two, against Toronto, and you realize, once again, he is the freight train that you can't stop. He gets put in positions to be successful when they run that spread pick and roll, and he's basically one-on-one at the rim, and if you help, he's one of the best passers of all time because he could see over the defense and everyone's a threat. And then you realize, once again, like, why are we so stupid in counting this guy out? And we do it every single, I don't know if I do it every year, but most of the time you wonder, like, is this the end? Is this the end? Is this the end? And then remarkable performances, once again, and makes us realize he is an all-time great, probably the second greatest player to ever live, and there's a reason he is that.
Brian, last thought. Utah is tied at one apiece in the West. You spotted this earlier in the season, and you were saying that the Jazz were going to mess up the West for everybody because they were not supposed to make the playoffs, but not only are they in, they're causing damage. What do you make of this Jazz team right now and the way they play?
So I thought Quinn Snyder was a good coach. I was wrong. He's a great coach. I thought Donovan Mitchell was an above-average rookie. Now, he's like an above-average player on the cusp of knocking on the door of being an all-star. And still the guy who I think – and he had less impact in this series, and he had a really good impact in that first-round series – is Rudy Gobert. So Jazz have exactly the makeup of what you want now. They have willing passers, guys that can shoot. They have good defense. They're well-coached. They're well-organized. And they have that man, which is a rookie, and it's hard to even imagine to be saying, that can go and get you buckets late in the game. So I don't think that they'll win this series, but what they have done so far, it makes you wonder, like is the league changing so much that no-name, like, rookies can have big-time impacts in the game, and, like, no-name players like Joel Ingles, who, you know, people in the NBA know who he is, but can actually change the outcome of playoff games, which, like, I would say 5 years ago, it always came down to your best three players and see what they can do, and your best player is better than their other best player. So I'm really loving what I'm seeing across the league. It's like we talked about the Celtics and the guys like Kyrie Irving, Gordon Hayward out, but other guys stepping up. I think we're seeing that across the league, and it's really fun to watch. We're all rooting for more parity, but I do think at the end of the day it's going to be Golden State and Cleveland once again. But this could be the last year of that.
He had an 11-year NBA career. He was an NBA champion, a Pac-10 legend. Brian, my man, you had a really nice basketball career, and you are having a great second career. Great to have you back, Brian. Thanks so much.
All right, Jim, anytime.
So addressing that first part, the Celtics are tough as hell. If you thought Philly was going to roll right in there and roll right over them, you could not be more wrong. And according to Marcus Morris, you were really wrong if you thought that Philly was the favorite in the first two games. He was told that after game two, they were in fact favored. And the guy was stunned. Quote, were they favored? When told that they were, he responded with, quote, they couldn't have been favored the first two games, could they? And told once again that that was the case, he said, quote, okay, bleep, this ain't Miami. Yeah, bleep, this ain't Miami. Slap that on some t-shirts and you'll sell a half a mil before the series even gets back to Boston. Boston isn't Miami. But in the first half, Philadelphia made them look like Miami. The Celtics blew the doors off, or the Sixers blew the doors off of them in the first half. They were up by 22 in the first half. And that was the Philly that everybody expected to see in that series. The Philly that did not show up in game one. Explosive on offense, nasty on defense, and killing you on the glass. But if you thought that lead was safe, then you don't know the Celtics. You don't know Brad Stevens. And most of all, you don't know my man, Terry Rozier. Quote, coach was saying, Whoever is the tougher team is going to win. They definitely punched us in the mouth at the beginning of the game. We just had to bounce back and get things together. End quote. Hell yes, they did. They took a haymaker to the face. They go down. They fumble around for their mouthpiece. But then they get back up and they go on a 50-20 run. Let me repeat that. A 50-20 run. Because, of course, they did. This team loves challenges. The more injuries they get, the fewer players they have, the better they get. And there's plenty to love of love to go around. I mean, you don't come back from down 22 in a playoff game thanks to only one guy. There was Jaylen Brown gutting it out for 13. Jason Tatum lighting it up for 21. And Al Horford, the most routinely disrespected all-star in the league, coming through for the game-icing shot. And, of course, the coach, Brad Stevens. Few guys, and Brian Scalabrine was all over this, few guys are better at finding your weaknesses and taking advantage of them than Brad Stevens. This guy literally made Ben Simmons disappear. He absolutely erased Ben Simmons from that game. 1 point. 1 point for a guy who's on the verge of being an absolute superstar in that league. It got to the point where the Sixers were better without Simmons in the game. In the second half, they were a better team with T.J. McConnell on the floor. Now, I never thought that I would say that, and I may never say it again, but that's the truth, and it's a testament to Brad Stevens. But last night, again, was by Terry Rozier. This guy's a star. He averaged just over 11 during the regular season, but he's up over 20 in the playoffs. His shooting percentages are way up. And why? Because he is built for these moments. But don't take my word for it. Take it from Drew Bledsoe. Drew Bledsoe busted out the Scary Terry t-shirt for game day. That didn't pump me up. When you break out a Drew Bledsoe throwback for game one, and then Drew Bledsoe breaks out a Scary Terry T for game two, you have to show up big. And Rozier did just that. Euro-stepping fools.
Rozier moving it. Rozier sidestep. Attitude. Wow.
There is Rozier finding Tatum for a lob.
Redick in the corner. No. Rozier the rebound. Speed dribble, leaving it up. Tatum throws it down.
Thanks to TNT. But nothing more impressive than the three in front of Philly's bench and the stare down with the Sixers players. You drop that shot, then you drop that stare. Damn good game. Damn good game, damn good series. It's going to be a damn good rivalry for years. That's the truth. And here's another one. I don't want this series going seven. I need this thing to go like 17. Because while it has all the makings of a great rivalry for the next 5 years, I want to binge watch those seasons right now. I don't want to wait until next season. Hell, I don't want to wait for game three. This is an on-demand world, and I demand that we stream these two teams playing each other nonstop for the next month. Go ahead and do that for me, will you? Tim Layden. Tim, good morning. Great to have you back. How are you?
Hey, good, Jim. Excited for the race.
Me too. Great to talk to you, and I am pumped for the race. Tim, we're about 24 hours out right now, and this is a tough, tough, deep group. What kind of thoughts are you having about the field as we get closer to post time?
You know, it's a really – obviously, everything is with the caveat that these horses are really early in their career and young, but it looks like there's at least half a dozen and maybe all the way up to eight of these horses that are – really promising. They've won races. They have talent. They have speed. You know, it's like I often tell people to think of Derby horses as sort of freshman college athletes. And there's half a dozen of these horses that you should think of as one and dones. You know, they're the kind of athletes that are really exceptional, and they've turned back all the challenges they faced so far, and now they're all getting thrown into the tank together. So it's kind of like a Sweet 16, and we're going to see really who kind of has that exceptional talent to move on.
Boy, it's such a great analogy that you make, and it's so true. Tim, you look at some of these horses, they really are exceptional, and they're gifted, and they've done amazing things already early in their career. Justify is the favorite. You made the point that 3 years ago, you were not on the American Pharoah bandwagon, but you're not going to make that mistake with Justify. So first, take me back. What were your impressions of American Pharoah before the Derby 3 years ago?
I thought he was great. I mean, I watched his Arkansas Derby in the mud, and I thought he moved like no horse I'd ever seen in my life. But, you know, Jim, there's just this, you almost get this contrarian attitude when you get here to Louisville, where everybody starts raving about this one horse, and you start to think, okay, this is like getting to be a little too much. I'm starting to feel like it's people are going overboard here, and I'm going to look for another way to go for a pick. And it was obviously the wrong attitude to have 3 years ago, because American Pharoah was transcendent horse, really the best one that we've seen in many generations, and I didn't want to get caught up in the hype, and because there's a lot of hype going around Churchill Downs during Derby week. You know, there's a horse named My Boy Jack that just opened at 5-1 in early betting when he should be 40-1. But as far as Justify goes, he doesn't move quite the way that American Pharoah did, but he looks the same way when he's standing still, and then when he moves, he doesn't have that amazing fluid action that Pharoah did, but he looks the part in every other way, and I'm going to say that I'm going to pick him to win, because I don't want to not pick the next Triple Crown winner in the Kentucky Derby. So if I'm going to go down, I'm going to go down on a horse that I think is really great.
Tim Layden joining us. So in Justify, Tim, he was amazing in the Santa Anita Derby. He looked good all week, but he's only run 3 races in his life. He did not run at all as a 2-year-old, and no horse since Apollo in 1882 has won the Kentucky Derby without running as a 2-year-old. So how significant is that? For instance, is that just some kind of interesting historical footnote, or is that something that people inside the sport are very aware of and it's a thing?
Yeah, I mean, something, when you got a streak that lasts 137 years, you can't turn your back on it. I mean, there's got to be something to that. And there is something to it. It's, you know, if you think of any athlete, the longer you've been training, the longer you've been getting to the gym, the longer you've been lifting weights, whether you're a housewife or a husband or you're an NFL player, the deeper your foundation of fitness is, the better you're going to be. And that's true with horses, too. And it's been true for 100 years plus that if you run enough races, then your system and your muscles are more attuned to the kind of challenge that you're going to face in the Derby, where they go mile and a quarter, 20 horses, 165,000 drunk people. It's a huge challenge, and the more that they've faced, the more they're ready for that. So there is something to it. At the same time, horses have been trained and bred differently over those 137 years that have gone by. They have raced fewer and fewer times. They've been bred more for speed. So most of the good trainers and most of the good handicappers agree that Apollo curse is going down eventually. And we're going to forget about it when it happens and realize that the entire industry is different now. And Justify just looks like the horse that, you know, if nothing crazy happens in the race, and crazy stuff does happen in the Derby, but if nothing crazy happens, he looks like a horse that could take it down. There's another horse, Magnum Moon, that won the Arkansas Derby, that also didn't race as a 2-year-old and also looks very talented. I just don't think he's quite as good as Justify.
Tim Layden joining us. All right, let me keep you right there, Tim. Magnum Moon also did not start as a 2-year-old, as you point out, but won the Arkansas Derby, which is a really nice race to win. Now, that run did include a little bit of a drift on the home stretch. Todd Pletcher would tell you that only happens when that horse is winning. I mean, is that comforting to hear, or do you think, Tim, when you see a horse drift or lug out, generally it's for a reason?
You know, Jim, you've been around the racetrack. I just, you know, I love Todd Pletcher. He's a talented guy, and I get along with him. But you got to divide anything that a trainer says in half. You know, he knows that future owners and future breeders are listening to what he says. They want to hear him talk good about his horse, not bad. To me, when a horse drifts out like that at the end of a race, again, you make the human comparison. If you're running a 5K or you're running a marathon or you're doing your CrossFit workout and your body starts to act weird because you're tired, there's a reason for that. And there's a lot of differences between horses and human beings, but there's a lot of similarities too. And I just don't like it. And if Magnum Moon is going to beat me on Saturday, then that's great. Then I'm going to believe Todd Pletcher that horse just gets distracted at the end of a race when he's way ahead. But to me, it's a red flag, and it's a red flag in any horse at any level. So I'm just gonna wait and let Magnum Moon prove me wrong.
I think you're right, Tim. He's a hell of a trainer. But generally, to me, if a horse is lugging out or drifting out, I think there's a reason for it. You made the comparison to humans. You've got this fascinating piece up right now on SI.com that looks at how a horse feels at max effort. And that idea first came to you during the 07 Belmont when Rags to Riches defeated Curlin. What was it about that duel down the stretch that inspired you to first start thinking about this?
That was a race where Rags to Riches was a 3-year-old filly that took on Curlin, who had won the Preakness and would go on to be a Breeders' Cup winner and a Horse of the Year. And those two horses hooked up at the quarter pole, which at Belmont Park, the quarter pole is a long, it's a quarter mile from the finish line, but it's into the home stretch. And they basically ran for 26, 28, 30 seconds together, right at each other's throats. Every stride, heads bopping up and down, breathing their lungs out. And it just blew me away that these horses were doing this. And with jockeys riding up and down on them, I just found myself thinking, you know, again, if you've been a human athlete in any way, if you have suffered in a sporting event, whether it's a running race or a swimming race or a basketball game, I just thought, do they feel like we do? Are they suffering? I don't want to get the PETA people mad at me. I don't mean suffering in the sense of cruelty to animals. I mean, are they feeling that burn that you feel as a human being? So, yeah, I wrote this piece this week where I talked to some human 800-meter runners because they run about 2 minutes, which is the length of the Derby. And then I talked to some vets and some exercise physiologists that specialize in horses. And the short answer is it's 99% certain that those horses are feeling that same burn in their lungs and that same numbness in their legs that humans do. And, you know, whatever you think of the sport, I think it's worth looking at it. When you see those horses coming down the lane, they're not just running. They're trying to beat back that pain and that suffering that every athlete feels.
You know, so is it similar then, Tim? I know exactly what you're saying. We see this in the horses. I think the equine athlete is a lot like human athletes, and there are just some that want it very, very badly. There are just some that will do anything they can to win. I mean, would you make that analogy? Are they like human athletes in that regard? You know, the ones that want it and the ones that will play through.
For sure. But the human athletes, we can see the expression on their face. We can see them gritting their teeth. We can talk to them afterward. You know, we can know that, you know, we can see that LeBron James wants the ball in the fourth quarter, even when he's played 40 minutes. And it's kind of, we feel more of a connection to the human because we can understand what's in his brain. The horse, you know, we can watch the effort, but that horse can't tell us afterward what he was thinking, what he was feeling. And, you know, in that regard, I just felt it was important to try and help people understand that, you know, they're feeling that. And if you see a horse that hangs on, you know, I also wrote about Bodemeister in 2012 getting caught at the line by I'll Have Another in the Derby after leading the race in just super fast fractions all the way around and then hanging on and getting beat by half a length at the wire. And I just think it's important for people to maybe, you know, take a look at outside what they bet on the race and outside the names and the silk colors and realize that these are living creatures with lungs and legs and hearts and brains, and that some of them do try harder than others, and some of them, no matter how hard they try, it isn't enough. And like on that day, you know, Bodemeister had been out there by himself setting the pace for too long with no help, and I'll Have Another just ran him down at the end. And it's just, but some of them do try harder. You're absolutely right about that.
Tim Lane, my guest. Tim, help me with this, because when I first got into it, I didn't fully understand this, and I tried to learn about this. And I think that normal lay fans might ask the question, does the horse know when they win or when they lose? Does the horse know if it's a bad beat? You know, if you have an athlete who gets their heart ripped out in a game, does that stay with them? Do they recover? Do they bounce back? I would argue that a lot of them do know if they win or lose. I mean, maybe it's just me, Tim, but, and you and I have talked about Share Belief in the past. When Share Belief got hammered at the start of the Breeders' Cup Classic, I was told, and I didn't spend a lot of time at the barn after that, I was told the horse literally was upset for 3 or 4 days. And you might say, come on, Rome. Are you kidding me? The horse was upset? The horse knew he had been beaten. I would argue they do know, a lot of them, when they win or when they lose. And if it's a bad beat, sometimes they never come back. Does that seem realistic to you?
I've had a lot of trainers tell me that horses understand. They know what's around them. You know, that's an animal that centuries ago ran in packs, in herds. They know when they're surrounded by animals. They know when they're all alone out in the front, you know. And I've had plenty of examples of people tell me that the horse that has been winning and winning, you think back to the great mare Zenyatta, who didn't lose till the last race of her career in the Breeders' Cup in 2010, and I think she was 18 or 19 and 0 at that point, and she lost by a small nose to a horse named Blame here at Churchill Downs. And when she finished that race and then they took the saddle and the jockey off her and she was walking back to the barn, she had her head down, she wasn't picking up her feet and dancing like she always did. And you know, you can wear yourself out trying to figure out what that means, but it means something. And, you know, I you can also say, hey, she got fed even though she got back there and she got her bath. But she, if you looked at the way she was moving after that race, after the first loss in her life, it was an awful strong case to me that she knew something was different and that people weren't cheering for her and there was nobody surrounding her, nobody put some kind of wreath around her neck. They know something. Anyone, you have a pet of any kind in your life, you know that animals are smart, and horses are no different. And, you know, there's people cheering tomorrow, 165,000, 170,000. I think the winner is going to know that that's for him.
I was going to say, Tim, I'd flip it on its head, too. I mean, she may have known that she didn't win and was dragging her feet a little bit. I've seen some horses after they win, man, they're full of themselves. They know. They're puffed out. They're walking around like they're it. They're a big deal. So they know, too, when they win.
For sure. And you can see the really good horses, and there's a bunch of them that are going to run tomorrow that have lost either none or no times in their life or once in their life, and they understand when they come out for that post parade, they look at the other horses and they will try and intimidate each other with the way they behave and the way they carry themselves. It's very much like you see in a human sport where, you know, you might get trash talking before a basketball game, or you might get, you know, football players that try and, you know, do a step over after a tackle to try and get into another player's head. Horses exhibit a lot of that same behavior when they've experienced success and when they know that they're good and when they know that they're fast and they expect to be out front. And, you know, it's something that you can see all the time in horses. And it's really the same type of behavior that you see in the best human athletes. And it's a fascinating thing to watch.
The countdown to the biggest day in the jungle continues. Smack Off 24, if you did not know, is Friday, July 20th. I think that's why we're having such a good week. In fact, I know that's why we're having our best call week of the year, because I made the announcement earlier this week, and I told you at that time, make sure you've got it cleared. Make sure you're listening or watching on CBS Sports Network. Make sure you're ready to follow along on Twitter and TweetDeck. I did my part by giving you the date with plenty of notice. Now you need to do your part by showing up. Speaking of showing up, nothing lets the host of the event know that you're going to be there better than with an RSVP. And for Smack Off, RSVPs, they do come a few different ways. Some guys like to text me. Some guys like to DM me. Other guys will reach out to staffers. Some will announce their intended presence on Twitter. But the absolute best way to do this, the best way to officially let the world know that you're going to be there for the biggest event, is by doing it on air. Nobody understands this better than the guy who did it yesterday. Smack Off 24 got its first on-air RSVP from the most unlikeliest of callers.
Let me first of all say, Jim, to the millions, Jim, and the millions of my peeps across the fruited plain, Jim, that finally, Jim, the dirtiest player in the game, Jeff from Richmond, has come back to the Jim Rome Show.
The dirtiest player in the game. I love how he still has millions and millions of followers. This cat hasn't called the show probably in 8 years. But the dirtiest player in the game is back. And you know what? He's right. Because that phone call carried the program yesterday. And if we don't hear from that guy between now and the Smack Off, at least we all know the dirtiest player in the game is going to be there on July 20th. One of my all-time favorite RSVP calls. Speaking of which, one of my all-time favorite RSVP calls may not have actually been an RSVP call at all, but it came from Mike in Indy last year.
I'm all over that number one spot like stank on S, and I'm going to have all these other callers screaming like that tennis chick when I win it again this year. These callers are going to be screaming, help me, help me. You can call this an RSVP call, Romy, but I don't do RSVP calls. I make RESPECT calls. Find out what it means to me calls.
Only that dude can make that line work. Or so I thought. Because as instantly classic as that was, Vic in NoCal had a very different take.
Mike, did you really come in here with an RESPECT, find out what it means to me blast? Really, Mike? Did you seriously just try to Aretha us? You corny, man. See, you came in here today, Mike, calling other people scrubs, but I don't think you even know what that word really means. See, a scrub is basically a guy who thinks he's fly. Also known as a buster. You know, he's always talking about what he wants, but he just sits on his broke ass. And that's you, Mike. And you just got TLC'd, my main man. You just got T L seed.
You corny, man. I mean, without question, one of the great, great rivalries in the jungle. Mike and Vic, DLC and Broadway. I think I speak for everyone when I say I hope there's a new chapter of hate between these two that's about to be written. Although I have not heard from either one of these two in a little while. A minute, or in the case of Mike, an hour. Another great RSVP call came back in 2016 from Mark in Boston when he phoned in to say that he was showing up for Smackoff 22.
Jim, I know the challenge before me is great, the odds are long, but much like Antonio Cromartie when he found out his wife's tubes were tied, challenge accepted.
I mean, that's so much better than a text, or a tweet, or a DM. And so is Mark in Hollywood's RSVP that very same year.
I'm going to drop a little piece of intel that I've come across, a little nugget of information that was leaked to me that's going to change the game. You heard it here first, clones. It's going to be a game changer. It's going to shake up the world. And I'm going to be bringing back the crown to the land, Hollywood land. Oh, I forgot. Leff and Laguna should give a lecture on how to not overcompensate due to micropenis syndrome. Rock me!
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Dude just went with a micro penis syndrome blast on Leff and somehow got that in under the buzzer. Somebody was a little slow with the trigger that day. No names mentioned. Cavs play-by-play announcer Lil Alvin DeLauro, the elf who badly needs a sandwich.
And then there's Alvy. Dude, I look at Alvy. I just want to mail him a sandwich. Elf needs food badly.
Elf needs food. Badly. 77 days till the Smackoff, Elf. Plenty of time to RSVP, but you cannot RSVP if you're not invited. And you can't be invited unless you have an exemption or a golden ticket. So if you want to RSVP anytime between now and then, but you don't have a ticket, then come rip a ticket. Start dialing. It's getting very late, very quickly. Smackoff 24, July 20. Let's get it. Let's go. Let's do it. Red Sox manager Alex Cora is my guest. Alex, it is great to have you on. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. How are you, brother?
My man, I'm great. Alex, it is so good to talk to you, and I really appreciate you doing it. You're 31 games in as your first season as Red Sox manager. There are a million things I want to talk to you about, but let me start right here. What has the entire experience been like so far?
It's been great. Honestly, as you know, in the city we play in, you know, sports rule the world, you know. Between the Celtics, the Bruins, the Patriots, the Red Sox, our fan base is as passionate as I am with my sport, you know, with baseball, and it's been a blast. I know, and as you know, we're going to have great days, you know, the media, the fans are gonna have a blast with us. Then we're going to have tough days with them too, but it's part of the experience. But so far, so good, man. I'm having a great time with it.
Alex Cora, my guest. I want to talk to you more about the experience in a moment, Alex, but let me ask you about a couple of your guys. You dropped a tough one last night in Texas, but in that game, Mookie Betts homered again. He's got four in the past two games. I know the two of you had a conversation in January where you told him the scouting report that you had on him when you were with the Astros. What was that scouting report?
It was his first two at-bats, he's auto-taken. That means, you know, he's taking a strike, and then after that, you can expand the zone. With two strikes, you can attack away and expand with the slider. He's going to run out of bat. What means is that he's not going to be able to make hard contact with pitches in the outside of plate. And basically, I told him, be ready to attack. You're going to be my leadoff hitter from the first day of the season until November, if everything goes right. So be ready. Be ready to hit. And he took it by heart. This is a guy that from pitch one, he's ready to hit, he's ready to attack, and that doesn't mean he's going to swing at the first pitch every time. But his mindset, and you can see it, his body language, he's telling the pitcher, you better execute from pitch one, if not I can do damage. And so far, so good. It's been great to see him perform. This is a very athletic guy that he's just finding, you know, new stuff, you know, swing-wise. Mindset-wise, and you see the results, and I'm very excited with him right now. And obviously, Looking forward for great results the rest of the season.
He took it to heart. He changed his approach. Alex Cora joining us. Now, Alex, I mentioned you were with my guy A.J. Hinch in Houston last year. He is one of my favorite managers in baseball. What was that experience like for you, and what was your biggest takeaway from your time with him?
Well, first of all, he's great with media. He does an outstanding job with the media. I know I'm in a different market, but he was awesome. You could see it during the playoff, the way he handled the whole the Yankee series, the Dodgers, everything with the bullpen. He never panicked, and he never showed panic, you know, to the media and the fans. Second, the way he connected with the front office, with the medical staff and the players, it's very important to make sure that it's not like separate groups. Usually, when you talk about organizations, the GM, you talk about the GM, and then you talk about the analytic department, and then you talk about the medical staff and the players and the coaching staff. And you don't want them to be split up. Actually, you want everybody to work together. And AJ has this ability to get everybody together, to work on the same page and obviously accomplish their goals. And that was my biggest takeaway. It was a pleasure working with him the whole season. We stay in touch. We talk a lot. We talk almost every other day, and he's helping me throughout the process. And I know he's off to a good start over there. They have a great team, and I'm very proud of him.
Red Sox manager Alex Cora, my guest. Alex, you made the point, and it's so true. I mean, you both have the similar gig, but the gigs are totally different in the sense that you've got a totally different media market. I mean, in fact, there aren't too many jobs in sports that come with more pressure than being the manager of the Boston Red Sox. You played in Boston, so you know the pressure that comes along with being in Boston, but as you've said, you did not go there to take that job to change who you are. So how do you approach dealing with that pressure and making sure that it doesn't change you?
Well, honestly, Jim, I learned a few years ago, I managed winter ball in Puerto Rico. I actually managed my hometown team, the Caguas Criollos. I was the GM and the manager. And for two seasons, you know, everything on the field was fine. I think the guys did an outstanding job. You know, my group, the coaching staff, we did a good job putting them in positions to be successful. But honestly, Jim, I didn't have fun. It was a grind for me. And I think those 2 years I changed as a person, you know, like I was trying to be too strict. I was stuffing the guys, but at the same time, you know, it was something weird. And, I actually ended up firing myself. You know, I was a GM saying, you know what, you're not going to manage next year. So I took a step back and I promised myself that the next time you manage, regardless where is it, able, AA, AAA, or the big leagues, you're going to have fun. You can't change, you know. You know the game. You're confident about it. You know you're going to connect with players. But at the end, you can't be miserable. You know, you know why? Because you got a family. And if I'm miserable, then I go into the house, you know, after games, and I'm not going to be a good dad. I'm not going to be a good husband. And I'm not going to be a good son, you know. So I promise myself, whatever happens, wherever I end up, I'm going to have a blast with it. I'm going to have fun. I'm going to be myself. And everybody around me is helping me out. I think I have a great support system. My family's there, and it's always fun when the game is over, regardless of the result, just to go home and be Alex, you know, and take care of the kids and make phone calls, talk to your friends, and disconnect at least for a little bit from what is a grind. We know it's 162 games. We know that, you know, if we play the way we want to, we have goals to accomplish in October, but without that support and be myself, it's not possible. So right now, so far, so good, man. And like I said before, Jim, it's been great to be in front of this team, and I know it's going to be great the rest of the season.
I see you working, Skip. What a great message for all of us, man. Don't bring it home. You're no good to anybody if you bring that home.
Yeah, you said it simple. You know, I have to go around and talk about the family and bring everybody to the equation, but that's the way it is, man. Don't bring home. I mean, you know how it is, man. 160, you go about it every day. You know, you have to do your show and do everything. You do your research, and you have good days and bad days. But at the end, man, the family's there for you. You have to take care of them.
and you got to be there for them. Alex Cora, my guest. You know, I'm glad you brought up Puerto Rico. Let me ask you this. When you were having conversations with the Red Sox about becoming their manager, you asked the team if they would support a relief trip to Puerto Rico in the offseason, and they were on board. And earlier this year, you, along with members of the organization, Alex, and a couple of the players, went to deliver supplies. When you look back on that trip, what do you remember most? What kind of memories do you have?
On the flight from Boston to San Juan, I told everybody, I said, be ready because it's something different. It's you know, what you're going to see, probably you've never seen in your life. But one thing you're going to get from the people we're gonna impact is true love. It's people that are very genuine. When they tell you thank you, it's coming from the heart. When they give you a hug, you're going to feel it. And after we were there, we impacted 300 families in my hometown. And Chris Sale was there, Rick Porcello, Sam Kennedy, Mayor Walsh, 65 people of the organization went down there with me. And that's what they told me afterwards. They were like, Alex, man, you were right. It was awesome. And this is not the end of it. We're going to keep working because, as you know, and as you saw 2 weeks ago when the Indians and the Twins played down there, we're not there yet, man. We need a lot of help. It's slowly but surely coming to where we want to be, but it's taking a while, and we need all the help we can get, and we're going to keep helping my Puerto Rico.
Good for you. Alex, one last thought. The plan tonight is to face Bartolo Colon. You were teammates with him 10 years ago. I got to know, what was he like as a teammate, especially as it related to, like, the Stairmaster and his TV viewing habits?
You see, man, so Bartolo, very talented. You know, I was just looking at his numbers, and he's been amazing this season. So in 2008, Bart was playing with us, and he had the Stairmasters upstairs. And as a member of the team, you got to watch the game. So on a TV on the left side, he has the game. Let's say we're playing the Rangers, and it's at 8 o'clock. And on the right-hand TV, there was a soap opera. So he was locked in both. muting the game and listening to the soap opera. But it was like the funniest thing. Just think about Bart and a Stairmaster, and then the soap opera on the right and the game on the left. It was unreal, man. This guy is amazing.
And the game was muted, but the soap opera was up. I mean, Alex, what's to say about this cat that he's still pitching in the major leagues at 44? What's to say about him as a professional that he's still doing it at 44?
Different pitcher. Remember with the Indians, it was 97, 98, and just throwing fastballs up. Now you see him pitch, and it's teaching. You know, if you're a high school pitcher, or you're thinking about becoming a pitcher, you know, in college or whatever, just see him go about his business. The way he places his fastball, his fastball away, fastball in, fastball away, fastball in, fastball up. This guy throws 85% fastball. In an era that, you know, it's now, if you're one of the best pitchers in big leagues, it's 50-50, 50% fastball, 50% breaking balls, and this guy is doing it with a fastball. His ERA is under 3. You know, it looks last year with the Braves, it seems like he lost it, but then he got it back, and he's a tough customer, man. We have a tough one in front of us. Let's see how we're going to attack him, but hey, man, he's doing an outstanding job. And talking about enjoying the game, enjoying your craft, he does it. He does that. And it's a pleasure to watch, but not tonight. Yeah.
Red Sox, 22-9. They're in first in the AL East. Their manager, Alex Cora, my guest. Alex, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you. That was an absolute blast. So great to have you on the show, Alex. Thank you very much, and good luck.
Thank you, Jim. We'll do it again.
What's going on? Welcome to the jungle. My name is Jim Rome. It is awesome to be with you on a Monday. A smack-off date announcement coming a little bit later on. Lots of NFL. Got some NBA, some NHL, some boxing, and more. Lots to get to. Got to start with some NBA, though. Something truly amazing happened in Game 7 of the Pacers-Cavs series yesterday.
Yeah! The Cavaliers finally.
I'm burnt right now. I'm not thinking about Toronto right
now. Shock
is
not that he showed up the way he did. It's that Tristan Thompson, Kevin Love, and George Hill showed up the way they did.
I'm ready to go home.
Smack-off 24.
You're entering a world of pain.
You want a piece of me?
I hope they get polio.
It's July 20th. Write that down. July 20th. I've said it. It's now official. Triple G is in studio.
He used drug. Oh, this disrespect to sport.
Is he a cheater?
He every time said he's clean. His test not clean. Ask him, please.
detonated and turned to rubble by the David Akers Demolition Company. Scoreboard, bitches. Cruz won his first NHRA race since 2014.
So I think this win is going to loosen our team up, including myself a little bit.
I like that kind of party, baby.
And the tower is still standing. The Celtics
Bradley
follow their
Kent
game seven
Stevens.
Triumph.
This guy's like a wizard a or a warlock or something. Howard Beck.
I'm just going to go with the Brad Stevens is a magician rationale.
Me too.
Center field off Matt Harvey and the struggles.
For struggling.
Matt freaking party.
Emailed.
Harvey drove 135 miles to party. Well, we'd walk 500 miles, sign the Proclaimers.
Step your game step up, your Rich game Ackerman, up. And don't allow these Canadian invaders to ruin our smack-off.
But you can't tell the difference between heroin and a guy who's been dead 5 years? Don't they teach that at cop school? Hey, Dad's never been in lockup that long. John Morosi joins us.
I really appreciate that Ghost Rider has now been entered into the canon of my life experience, which I very much enjoy.
Man's game. Yeah.
This guy's barely 1 foot onto the floor and already knocking in a three. I mean, ridiculous.
Hey, Jim Rome.
Hey, Steph Curry.
In case you forgot, I wanted to remind you of what the NBA is.
What?
A man's game.
Oh!
I just want somebody to punch him in the face.
If you feel that strongly about it, then punch me in my face when you see me.
We're talking about Draymond and Chuck punching each other in the face. It's incredible. It's fantastic. Keep it coming.
For him to talk like he's poly purebred, come on, Barkley.
John Lynch, what's it like for you to make that phone call knowing that you're delivering news guys have been dreaming about for their entire lives?
It is so cool. I'm getting chills talking to you about it because I've been there before.
Albuquerque, you tell me, what is more insidious in your community? Meth or Rex?
Everybody needs to pump their brakes when it comes to LeBron James.
LeBron James.
Micah Hyde. And Micah, the 619's the spot, isn't it?
Oh, there's, my God.
There's a sign that says America's finest city. It might be, right?
Dude, it is, for sure. That's why any chance we get, if it's a long weekend, you can find me in the 619.
And then there's Alvy. Dude, look at Alvy. I just want to mail him a sandwich. Elf needs food. Badly.
Elf needs food. Badly.
Josh Jackson, my guest.
My mind said this just to go up and try to moss somebody.
Great cash, homie.
Just go up and catch the ball. Go get him.
Their GM, Les Snead, is my guest.
If we don't finish this off and win this division, I'll be disappointed.
Looking at the call screen right here. Richmond, Jeff.
Jim, thanks for the vine, and thanks for the time. It doesn't matter what you think. Boyish good looks of Tom Cruise in a fine luxury sled, custom-made Armani suit. Aloha means goodbye. Or Jake and Rogan Lowe without the nicks and cuts of a blade.
Romy, I don't know why Jeff is getting so much credit for calling anyway. His wife Marie called like 3 months ago.
Who am I speaking to?
Bass Ackwards Ranch Hand.
Palatial estate in Virginia. We know that was about 10 years in a supermax federal penitentiary for sex crimes, Jeff.
How are you, sir?
Somebody please call the jungle police because I am verbally murdering this inbred.
Do not expect anyone to welcome you with the home bottle bomb.
Bob Myers.
Jim, any game you want, let me know. If we keep playing here, come to a game.
In a galaxy far, far away, Chewbacca. Rack him. Thanks, Joey. It is May the 4th. Jim Layden.
You know, Jim, you've been around the racetrack. You know, I love Todd Pletcher. He's a talented guy. You got to divide anything that a trainer says in half.
Bob in Calgary.
Do you remember Sarah Jessica Parker when Sex in the City was canceled? Dude.
Anytime, Robin. Alex Cora is my guest.
So Bartolo, he had the Stairmasters upstairs. So on a TV on the left side, he had the game. And on the right, there was a soap opera. So he was locked in both.
And his once trophy wife now resides in my bedroom.
Racks on, racks on, racks on, racking.
This is by far the best sports talk show in the country.
I plead the fifth.
Yes, sir, Mr. Rome. Thank you for having me.
The cloth hand dryer.
Dropping.
Next time he plays that monster's theme when he mentions my name.
That lunch of the mic, lunch of the mic.
Thanks, brother. Time to walk the dog.
He just punched himself in the face.
You are the urinal in my living room, brother.
Nice knowing you, champ.
And until next time, Jim.
Good night now! Bob in Calgary. What's up, Bob? How are you?
I'm good, Rome. I truly believe horses do get depressed after losing something, because do you remember Sarah Jessica Parker when Sex in the City was canceled?
Anytime, Alvin. Anytime at all, Alvin.
You don't like that cop.
Alvin's like, this guy says, hey, Rome, I agree with you. I think horses do know when they lose, and I think they do get depressed. Do you remember Sarah Jessica Parker when Sex in the City got canceled? Some waiting. Make any sense. 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-Mississippi, 4-Mississippi. Alvin's like just letting that marinate. Just let that sink in there. My man, Oren, what's going on? How are you?
I'm great, and that is an honor. You have no idea. That setup, I mean, Jesus. Thank you, though. I really do appreciate it.
Oren, let me jump in. Oren, I gotta say, man, I don't know if you've heard that call. I don't know if you heard that call or it just kind of worked its way back to you. Dude, that thing is an amazing thing to listen to 10 years out. When's the last time you heard that whole call in its entirety?
Well, yesterday.
Okay. All right.
Because shout out to Stugnut. You know what I mean? He kept me. I was telling Hawk that, you know, I my Twitter feed blew up and I looked into it and then, you know, listened to the reset and was listening to the show and you played the call again and I was like, damn, that, you know what I mean? That takes me back. And, you know, time, Jimmy is undefeated, right? You know what I mean? And nothing, though, is as timeless as delusion. So once again, shout out to Stugnut. It turns out, I guess, that a decade later, more than a decade later, Jeff still has all of his luxury things. For some odd reason, hasn't thought better of keeping them in Richmond, but that's beside the point. Listen, Jeff, parading around Richmond in the same sherbet orange Armani suit you've been rocking for more than a decade does not make you fresh, bro. It makes you Uncle Rico, fam. I mean, we all know that you can throw a Nerf over a mountain and we still don't care. Jeff is what? He's a Trump backer, shocker, a Kanye fan. Jeff, you left out a couple of things that you and Yeezy have in common. Copious amounts of methamphetamine, an affinity for tattered sweatpants and T-shirts, and your appreciation for the merits of slavery as a choice. That, Jimmy, is what I call extrapolated free thinking on my part. Jesus Christ, Kanye, by the way. Did you really just white-splain 400 years of oppression for the Jeff and Richmonds of the world? Listen, though, I did not come in here to catch a body. I did my time, like you said yesterday, in Jungle Pelican Bay. That's nearly a decade on air in Denver sports radio and television. I got paroled, a.k.a. I got canned from both jobs. Relocated to SoCal to work in the film industry. Became an elitist in my mind and extremely embittered in my daily commute. I like my time on the outs, and I plan on staying there. But then yesterday, I heard that 5 racks was on the line. And I thought, you know what, Oren? Oren could use 5 racks because all this SoCal sun and third personage ain't paying for itself. I don't know if I belong amongst the new class of smackers. Much like Trapper, I usually spend a lot of my time now concerned with the state of our union. I plug out from the jungle. I plug back in. Jimmy, I do have a question for you, though, that you can help me with. I'm trying to figure out what being a clone for this long in the jungle is more like. Is it more like, you know, walking back into that landmark sports watering hole where everything stays classic, all the way down to the bar stools. The owner, the sole proprietor, that'd be you, is slinging fire takes. And with the exception of a few regulars, the only thing that changes is like the liquored up and bitter blue-talking a-holes. Or is the jungle like today's rap game? And I'm like a Nas. You know what I mean? Just listen to me on this. I got one class album to my name, that called on Jeff, and a respectable body of work other than that. And then the rest of these cats are just a bunch of littles rambling unintelligently. I mean, I don't own a helicopter like Lil Left. I know nothing about balloons, heroin, or smuggling like Lil Benny and Wisco. And I'm not sure if I can keep up with Lil Caleb on a vine between high school AP English and study hall in Green Bay. Listen, my daughter was listening, though, yesterday, Jimmy. And Caleb, to say the least, she thinks your pipes are a little bit delicate. I came up with the Iafrades, the Marences and Tierra Sadres, the Kerwin and Riversides, the Detolas, the Silk Thrust, bruh. But it is tight to be thought of in a positive jungle light. And I will always be grateful for the platform that you've laid out here for all of us, Jim. And being mentioned is an honor and a privilege that's not lost on me. So with that said, I will leave you with this. Smack off time again. My golden ticket, please, thanks. 5 Grr, F yes, please. Racks on, racks on, racks on, racking!
Smack off 24, July 20. Let's get it. Let's go. Let's do it. Now this guy is invited. Back to the phones. Let's go to Buffalo. Rick in Buffalo is in already unless I snatch that golden ticket and he gets helicoptered. But right now, he's in. We go there right now. Rick, what's going on, brother?
Always great to be back in, Jim. Right off the top, let me address the featherweight clones who keep accusing me of stealing Jeff and Richmond's swag. I've sounded this way since I was 5, and I've been pulling older chicks ever since. You know, you're really dumb enough to believe I'd model my game after that broken-down train wreck. You heard that call yesterday. Jeff sounded like he just woke up from a 10-year nap and then accidentally butt-dialed the show. His timing was off, his material dated, and just when you thought it couldn't get any worse, he shouts out to his boy, Rogan Loam. Nice touch, Jeffrey. And as I tweeted out yesterday, Jim, Jeff was like the former Major League slugger who showed up on Old Timers Day and could barely swing the bat. Now let me give you the real update on Jeff in Richmond. He traded in those 26-inch pipes for a 52-inch waistline. His mannerly countryside estate went into foreclosure in 2008, and his once trophy wife now resides in my bedroom. And although yesterday's call killed your legacy, Jeffrey, there's still a chance to save your dignity. So I'm going to tell you this one time and one time only. Don't come around here no more, brother, because your old bones can't handle the hate that furrows deep inside my soul. And Jim, did Caleb in Green Bay really come in here and try giving me a few pointers? Since when is a guy who still shares a bed with his sister and walks around with permanent ketchup stains on his shirt qualified to give anyone advice? I'm getting real sick of you, Caleb. You really are an impossible guy to like, and it's got nothing to do with the fact you're fat and ugly. Caleb was all over Twitter humble bragging that Jim said he was the best caller never to win the smack off. You got to listen more carefully, Lev, because what he really said was, you're the biggest breasted caller never to win the smack off. So congratulations. That's a title you're never going to relinquish. War the smack off season. Thanks for the vine, Jim. I'm out.
Rick in Buffalo. Rackham, I don't think we have to speculate any longer as to whether or not that guy might get helicoptered. He's in. Trapper, my man, are you in Lexington?
I am in Lexington, my brother, and it's good to hear you. It's a great day. Oren, great call.
How about that, dude?
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jimmy.
I was going to say, how about that? How about Oren showing up?
Oh, just excellent. Fantastic call. And Jeff, welcome back. We didn't always hit it off, and it was nice, you know, using you for T-ball. But anyhow, just listening to Oren's call just brings back the memories. And to watch the evolution of this show and like Benny and Wisco, all the new talent, it just totally is illustrative of why this is by far the best sports talk show in the country. And that's just not just pimping you, but it is. And all because of you, Jimmy. Appreciate it very much. Yeah, back here in Lexington, great. I was at Keeneland the other day, watched the Bluegrass Stakes. But I'll get to that in a minute. Back here for this new immunology treatment where they put this railroad spike into your chest, and then they pull out a bunch of blood and mix it up with a cocktail. 3 days later, they reinfuse it back into you, and hopefully it stimulates your immune system and does something about this bug that I've been carrying around. So. It's good to be back here.
Trapper, brother, how you feeling? How are things? Bring us up to date. How you feeling?
I feel good. I'm working out every day. I dropped 35 pounds. I'm still stage 4 in terminal. But every day, Jimmy, I look in the mirror and I say, after I hit my knees, and I say, you know, today I get to and fill in the blanks. I got Connie, a beautiful woman I'm going to marry. I'm talking to my pal Jim Rome and listening to Oren, thinking back, bringing back some great memories. Get to drive around the horse country. I was just yesterday driving around Claiborne and then Calumet, Three Chimneys, looking at the new foals, kicking up their heels, feeling what it's like to feel that champion blood running through their veins and watching it. It's just the one thing about in this terminal crap, it's just, you know, who does not have a day with a number on it?
And it just makes you think a little, makes you appreciate life a lot more. So I am doing great. It is so good to be on the jungle with you. And I got another day, and I am really digging life. Things are very good.
Hey, Trapper, real quick, two things. Number one, you got another day, all right. July 20th is your day, so make sure you clear your schedule for that, right?
I am honored. Thank you very much, Jim.
Good night now!